unquote. The men in the White House express the ideal and the values, the frailties and the flaws of the voters who send them there. It is altogether natural that we should want to know more about the virtues and the vices of the fellows we have elected to govern us. As we know more about them, we will know more about ourselves. The French political philosopher, Joseph de Maistre, said, "Every nation has the government it deserves." At the start of the 21st century, 42 men have made it to the Oval Office. George W. Bush is counted our 43rd president because Grover Cleveland, who served non-consecutive terms, is counted twice. Of the parade of presidents, a dozen or so lead the polls periodically conducted by historians and political scientists. What makes a great president? Great presidents possess, or are possessed by, a vision of an ideal America. Their passion, as they grasp the helm, is to set the ship of state on the right course toward the port they seek. Great presidents also have a deep psychic connection with the needs, anxieties, dreams of people. "I do not believe," said Wilson, "that any man can lead who does not act under the impulse of a profound sympathy with those whom he leads, a sympathy which is insight, an insight which is of the heart rather than of the intellect." All of our great presidents, said Franklin D. Roosevelt, were leaders of thought at a time when certain ideas in the life of the nation had to be clarified. So Washington incarnated the idea of federal union, Jefferson and Jackson the idea of democracy, Lincoln, union and freedom, Cleveland, rugged honesty. Theodore Roosevelt and Wilson, said FDR, were both moral leaders, each in his own way and his own time, who used the presidency as a pulpit. To succeed, presidents must not only have a port to seek, but they must convince Congress and the electorate that it is a port worth seeking. Politics in a democracy is ultimately an educational process, an adventure in persuasion and consent. Every president stands in Theodore Roosevelt's bully pulpit. The greatest presidents in the scholars' rankings, Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt, were leaders who confronted and overcame the Republic's greatest crises. Crisis widens presidential opportunities for bold and imaginative action, but it does not guarantee presidential greatness. The crisis of secession did not spur Buchanan, or the crisis of depression spur Hoover to creative leadership. Their inadequacies in the face of crisis allowed Lincoln and the second Roosevelt to show the difference individuals make to history. Still, even in the absence of first-order crisis, forceful and persuasive presidents, Jackson, Theodore Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, are able to impose their own priorities on the country. The diverse drama of the presidency offers a fascinating set of tales. Biographies of American presidents constitute a chronicle of wisdom and folly, nobility and pettiness, courage and cunning, forthrightness and deceit, quarrel and consensus. The turmoil perennially swirling around the White House illuminates the heart of the American democracy. It is the aim of the American Presidents series to present the grand panorama of our chief executives in volumes compact enough for the busy reader, lucid enough for the student, authoritative enough for the scholar. Each volume offers a distillation of character and career. I hope that these lives will give readers some understanding of the pitfalls and potentialities of the presidency, and also of the responsibilities of citizenship. Truman's famous sign, "The buck stops here," tells only half the story. Citizens cannot escape the ultimate responsibility. It is in the voting booth, not on the presidential desk, that the buck finally stops. Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. Preface. The United States in 1800 was a political phenomenon, an independent nation sprung from European colonies, a republic in a world of monarchies, a unique society resting on a broad base of property-owning family farmers. Enslaved men and women composed one-fifth of its population, 40% to 60% in southern states, But that horrendous fact did not prevent America's leaders from speaking ardently of inalienable rights to justify their revolution. Independence brought self-government to the American states, but self-government was not the same as participatory democracy. That would require a more thorough transformation of American political culture. To accompany Thomas Jefferson through his presidency is to follow the tumultuous changes that turned the United States into a democratic nation, albeit one that tolerated slavery. In leading America toward democracy, Jefferson also instilled the nation with his liberal convictions. That is, he succeeded in limiting the scope of government while protecting the informal public realm where people could form organizations, engage in politics, and freely trade with one another. So familiar to us are these elements of public life that we easily forget that it took a foresighted leader to pluck from the quiver of America's possibilities the two arrows of participatory politics and limited government. Like the first decade of the 21st century, the first years of the 19th century found the world on the edge of a profound transformation. But, whereas globalization in our century has many advocates, in 1800 few people expressed belief in democracy. At the dawn of the new century, elitist attitudes prevailed in America. The spirit of equality animated some philosophers and reformers, but the people around them could scarcely fathom what egalitarian practices might involve. Most Americans, particularly the upper-class leaders of the Revolution, considered political independence their great triumph. They looked upon further social change as an invitation to the disorders they had already lived with during the protracted war with Great Britain. According to conventional wisdom, the world was divided between the few and the many, the talented few who led and the ordinary many who labored. Privilege had a special social bite. Plain men and women deferred to ladies and gentlemen when they entered a room or passed them on the road. Assumptions of superiority and inferiority lodged in children's minds and grew into the unexamined assumptions that silently supported adult attitudes. In European society, the vast majority of people were so poorly fed, so wretchedly dressed, that they seemed like a race apart. In the United States, there really did exist a race apart. The enslaved men, women, and children originally from Africa who occupied the bottom rung of a social ladder not crafted for climbing. In his conviction that America was destined to become a democracy, Jefferson differed from the cohort of leaders who had fought for American independence. They, of course, believed in freedom and made every effort to form governments that respected civil liberties and extended the suffrage. They admired the sturdy independence of the typical American man, which distinguished him from the middling sort in Europe, but they retained the respect for rank that dominated conventional thought. Jefferson alone, among his American peers, anticipated the age of democracy and bent every effort toward hastening its peaceful, consensual arrival. Awareness of the deeply ingrained biases of a ranked society is essential to understanding what the democratic transformation of the United States involved. Jefferson is remembered as the author of the Declaration of Independence, an early advocate of religious freedom, and the purchaser of the Louisiana Territory. But his most unusual gift was that of political imagination. He resisted the notion that political equality was a chimera, and strove to root out the last monarchical remnants from American culture. This work put him at odds with the country's privileged upper class, and especially its political arm, the Federalist Party. To be sure, Jefferson sought political equality solely for ordinary white men and disguised that limitation in the rhetoric of universal rights. With respect to women and people of other races, he shared the prejudices of his peers. Jefferson's particular mix of traditional and unconventional affirmations accounts for his tenacious single-mindedness and his confusing ambivalences, his successes as well as his failures. Was he for universal rights? Was he against slavery? Did his racial prejudices undermine his reform program? Did his distorted picture of women prevent his being a democratic pathbreaker? These questions about Jefferson passed seamlessly from 19th century contemporaries to scholars to members of the public in the 21st century. Jefferson raised his voice against slavery on several important occasions, but he died convinced that whites and free blacks could never prosper together once slavery ended. He enjoyed the conversation of intelligent women, but taught his daughters that women were created for men's pleasure. He approached Native American culture with avid curiosity, but recommended the ruthless destruction of Indian ways. These repellent convictions jostled strangely with Jefferson's generous conception of the human potential. If they appall us, they should also provoke our wonder that anyone born in the bosom of a misogynist, slaveholding aristocracy could have dreamed of a society of equals. Scholars are loath to credit a single individual with responsibility for momentous social changes, and they are correct. Most historical events have deep roots. The democratization of American society in the early 19th century is no exception. From the beginning of European settlement on the North American continent, it had been difficult to transplant government authority, social formalities, and economic regulations. American men, just because they had access to land, voted in larger numbers than anywhere else. The economic base of family farms and owner-run plantations nurtured independent ways. American prosperity promoted personal confidence and easy communication across class lines, the raw material for participatory politics. To these foundations for a democratic society, Jefferson added rhetorical inspiration, political wisdom, and upper-class connections. As an insider, he saw the obstacles that elite prejudices and pretensions placed in the way of democratic practices. A highly ingenious leader, he was able to lay out a route around them. Jefferson's vision accounts for the almost utopian zeal of his two administrations. They certainly explain his animus toward the Federalist Party for installing a network of upper-class families to monopolize offices in the new constitutional order. By the time he became president, Jefferson had, for 8 years, led a rambunctious political movement manned by thousands of white men eager to assert their right to be heard and esteemed. In opposing the Federalists, he ushered in a kind of sustained partisan activity that had never existed before. Initially called the Republican Party, it became known in the era of Andrew Jackson as simply the Democracy. Later on, it was called the Democratic Party. But even the modern Republican Party, formed in 1854, chose its name in part to honor Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson remains the most controversial of the presidents of the United States because the contradictions in his ideals still affect Americans profoundly. They touch on natural rights, race, and the proper balance between liberty and equality in democratic rule. Jefferson sought change, innovation, novelty, but he was decidedly not a deracinated intellectual, writing incendiary tracts in a garret like Thomas Paine. Rather, he was an insider, repeatedly elected to high office by his peers, the slave-owning planters of Tidewater, Virginia. It's safe to say that rarely, if ever, has a man with such a radical bent won so many elections from such an electorate. Solving this puzzle strains our historical imagination. Jefferson called his election America's Second Revolution. As real a revolution in the principles of our government as that of 1776 was in its form. Inclined to treat this claim as a bit of Victor's hyperbole, historians have not taken the pronouncement very seriously. This biography will. Two avenues of transformative change in Jefferson's presidency will get attention: his radical commitment to limiting government and his eradication of elite practices in the federal government. He was surely the first head of state who deliberately set out to narrow the scope of his and his successor's authority. And he succeeded, restraining the energetic government of his predecessors. He was also, and somewhat paradoxically, a self-conscious social engineer, using his discretionary powers to promote new democratic manners for the United States. Jefferson assumed power as an adversary. His inauguration climaxed a particularly rancorous election. Partisan campaigns had not been anticipated by the Founding Fathers 14 years earlier. This was virgin political territory. Or to change the metaphor, President Jefferson had to reach office through a minefield. Once there, he transformed an amorphous opposition movement into a political party disciplined in governing. Once in office, Jefferson bent every effort to creating a liberal democratic America. These historic developments form the interpretive matrix for this biography of America's third president. Chapter 1. A Pivotal Election. On March 4, 1801, a tall, narrow-shouldered man in his late 50s emerged from a boarding house in the capital city of the United States. He was heading for his inauguration as the country's third president. Disdaining the company of dignitaries or an honor guard, Thomas Jefferson walked with